This is episode 8 of the Bad Apples Season 4. Hi, my name is Klaatu, and this is my podcast about Linux and geeky things and all that other good stuff. This episode is just a big, long laundry list of really neat command line applications. I'm going to cover a lot of different things, definitely not the basics like copy and move, looking beyond those and just doing some stuff on like everyday applications in an X-less environment, an environment without X. Can you imagine such a thing? Well, I can, and you will too after this episode. Asmuth asked me in IRC the other day if I had a link to a page with all the big important command line applications that one might need if, for instance, one is installing Slackware on an old computer and probably doesn't even anticipate running X. I figured I probably did, and it turns out I didn't. There is a book called The Linux Pocket Guide or something like that. It's by O'Reilly. I remember I think it has a cowboy on it panning for gold or something, and it is literally pocket size. But I don't have it anymore. I think I did have it at one point, or maybe I'd checked it out, something like that, or I looked at it, but I don't have it anymore. It's a pretty good little book, but it's not online, so that doesn't qualify. And I kind of did a quick search to find something like that, and I to my surprise, I couldn't find one. I mean, I could find all kinds of posts on how to use a certain command or a place with lots of cool commands, but nothing like that. Just was like, here's your OS in a text console. And again, I don't mean those little intros to Unix, like how to navigate ls, cd, mv, you know, things like that. That, I think, is handy to know, and it gives you a good feel for how to do stuff in the terminal, but it's just not it's not that kind of, here's what you're going to use if you already are kind of familiar with the terminal, but, you know, you want to start using it for your everyday activities. So I thought I'd come up with one. I kind of think of the commands in three different groups, although two of them are actually kind of the same. So the two that are kind of the same is the quote-unquote OS functions and the sysadmin functions. And the OS functions, to me, are the things that you do in the terminal that are akin to something you would do just kind of in your file manager. You know, doing things that, you know, switching windows or minimizing a window or moving files around, things like that, although I'm not going to talk about moving files because that's sort of a basic thing, but that kind of thing, that's OS. Sysadmin, I think of things a little bit fancier, like SSH or SCP or rsync or even ifconfig and iwconfig and dhclient, things like that. I mean, that's where they kind of intersect because those commands are really kind of OS because they're basically a network manager, but you get my drift. There are things that you kind of do for yourself. There are things that you kind of do for your system, quote unquote. And then there are things that you do as a user, the user space applications like media players, office applications, things like that. So primarily I'm talking about things that do not require X and do not want you to have X open in order to work. So let's talk about a couple of commands or a couple of dozen commands that I use on a daily basis, some of them fairly simple, some of them fairly complex. I'm not going to be able to go through each one in extreme detail, but it is something I think worth noting. The first one I thought of for some reason is FG for foreground. Foreground is, a lot of people think of it as being deprecated by screen, because now if you want to switch, you know, within the same console, the same virtual console, or the same terminal, you just, you know, you invoke screen and you start running within screen and you can do your control A in or control A P to go back and forth between windows, or control A C to create a new window. And that's true, but I still find myself using FG and jobs in screen because I actually run as a couple of different users usually, and part of this is just to kind of keep myself organized, and part of this is to keep myself sort of used to having a multi-user system, because if you always run as one user, then you're never going to understand why Linux is considered a multi-user system. And if you ever want to be, you know, to administrate a system with multi-users, you might as well kind of start getting familiar with the idea of having multiple users running at the same time. So yes, I'll have screen open. In fact, I have screen invoked whenever I start up console, and more on that later. But I have it running, but I'll have two different users running within screen. So many times I will want to do something as a certain user, and I will control Z to send it to the background, and then I can do whatever I want to do. And then I'll FG1 or FG2 or just FG back to get that application that I control Z'd back into the foreground. So if you don't know how that works, most applications in the terminal will allow you to hit control Z, and it sends that application to the background. You can try this with, for instance, IRSSI, for instance. If you're in IRSSI, in IRC, and suddenly you realize you need to go, remove a file. Instead of opening up, certainly instead of switching to a different console, you know, with Alt-Control-F2 or something, all you have to do is hit Control-Z. That sends IRSSI to the background. Go and remove the file that you want to remove, and then just hit FG, and IRSSI will come right back on. You won't have missed anything. It's a beautiful thing. It's like minimizing a window, in a sense, in a GUI. Now, let's say if you're like me and you've got like Alpine and IRSSI and, you know, something else running at the same time, then you aren't just going to be able to hit FG. You need to define which job you want to bring to the front. And the way that you can find out what you're running is typing in jobs, J-O-B-S. This brings up IRSSI, for instance. Let's say I'm looking at the manual page for, FG. So number two job might be man FG. And then let's say I was typing something. So job three would be vim, foobar.txt. And then maybe job four would be alpine. So then I can just type in, okay, FG2, and that'll bring me back to man FG, and I can browse through that. And when I'm finished, rather than hitting Q to quit, I can just hit Control-Z to hide it again and select a different number of a job to bring up, for instance, FG1, and suddenly I'm back in IRSSI. So this is a very, very handy trick. If you don't use FG and jobs, you should. So Control-Z hides it, FG brings it to the foreground, and if you do that a lot, like with lots of different applications open, like an IRSSI session, Vim, a man page, and Alpine, then you'll want to list what you've got open, so you just type in jobs, and you're back in. And again, the reason that this is different and distinct and helpful as opposed to screen is that you can do that within the same user, whereas if you are signed in as Klaatu, and maybe you're running as, let's say, Klaatu and Gort, so you've got Klaatu open with a screen session, but within that screen session you're signed in as well, you've done an su-gort, then just opening a new screen session is going to sign you, is going to open a new screen prompt, a new prompt, bash prompt, at Klaatu. But you really wanted to do something as Gort, so you'd have to su-gort, password, and then do what you wanted to do. Way too much work. Just in your Gort screen, Control Z, do what you need to do, FG to bring it back. Simple as that. Very, very handy. And that's like, you know, old school Unix. I mean, that's the way they used to do it before they got screen, I guess. So it is still very, very relevant, very handy. Basically like minimizing screen windows in a GUI. LS would be the next function that I would say that I use a lot. Obviously, LS is list, but do you know the different ways to list? Do you know LS-ALH, for instance, which would show all in list form with human-readable file sizes? And even something like LS space dash capital F-A-H capital G-S-I-L-T, which shows it with practically everything you could ever want. I even forget all of the different options that that shows me. It shows me the user, the group, the last time it was modified. It shows all the hidden files. It sorts them it sorts them by something. I think by last modified. Just all kinds of cool stuff. So that one I use. I have that aliased in my bash to LA, and that just shows me everything I could ever want. So that's kind of nice. I mean, I don't use it all the time, but when you want it, it's handy to have. So those are the kinds of things that you kind of want to get familiar with, I think. And again, that's kind of OS level stuff. Grep, obviously, grep is you know, that's the one that everyone always talks about when they try to show you that Unix is so hard. You know, commands for Unix are so cryptic. I mean, words like grep and ls, big deal. But yeah, grep you should obviously always. I mean, you should get to know it. Dash I use a lot for the case insensitivity, so that if you just want to search for the word, you know, hacker, and you can't remember if you capitalized the H or not, do a dash I, or don't use capitals ever. But I don't even do that. Chown, C-H-O-W-N. Of course, that's a really important one. At some point, you're going to have to modify the ownership of a file, you know, for some reason. You'll be copying something from some drive that you had made as root, and it sees it as root, and it sees everything on there as root. You're going to have to copy it over, or you're going to copy it from one user to another user, and then you need to chown it to the other user. Chmod, C-H-M-O-D. Of course, that's modifying permissions for the file. This one is one of my favorites because I like the math that you can do with it, but I'm not going to go into the math because I don't think I could explain it very well. It's 421, that's as much as I'll say. But yeah, you know, you got to chmod things, and it's going to be something that you'll want to learn, both the alphabetical way of doing it and the mathematical way. The mathematical way is just easier and faster once you know it, but you know, if you can get by with just the alphabetical stuff. And of course, the quick and easy way of that is things like chmod gu plus rx foo.txt. That's going to give reading and executing rights to groups and to the group and the user. Or chmod go minus r bar.txt. This will revoke, for instance, the reading privileges of the group and others from bar.txt. tar, gzip, and bzip. And zip. All those are obviously very important to remember how to do that. And I remember very clearly when this was a real issue for me. I could never remember the commands, you know, to untar something or un-gzip something. And it was always this big chore for me to go look it up in my little notebook on how do I untar that again. And, you know, you can do it. I think people fall into that trap if they're doing it in the GUI a lot. If they're using GNOME or KDE, they right-click on a file and they say, okay, unarchive that. But if you're running without X, you're going to need to know the way to create tars and to unarchive tars. So really quickly, it would be tar cf archive.tar, foo png, and bar.og. And that's going to tar, it's going to create the file, cf, going to create the file archive.tar out of the two files that you've named after it, foo.png and bar.ogg. Easy enough, right? And then the untarring of it is really pretty simple. It's just tar xf, so extract files, archive.tar. So it's pretty simple. Gzip archive.tar. That's going to gzip the file archive.tar and create something called archive.tar.gz. And it just does that automatically. You don't have to give it the name of the new file, the destination file. To un-gzip it, you gunzip, G-U-N-Z-I-P, archive.tar.gz. That un-gzips the archive.tar.gc into archive.tar. Or, of course, more realistically, you're probably going to want to both un-gzip it and untar it at the same time. And luckily, the friendly programmers over at TAR have given us that option with TAR XZF archive.tar.gz. That's gonna gunzip and untar archive.tar.gz into foo.png and bar.og. And it's probably worth noting that you kind of want to be careful about doing it that way, because you know, when someone un-gzips it and untars it, and it puts files just kind of, it just drops them. I think they call that a tar bomb, I think is what I heard. That's kind of annoying. So you probably, before you go and tar something and gzip it, you probably want to make a directory for it first and put those files into the directory, so that when someone untars it and un-gzips it, what they end up with is one single directory containing all your data, rather than all your data scattered throughout whatever directory they unzipped it in. That's kind of good practice, and something I'm obviously not demonstrating here. And then, I mean, it's really, I mean, bzip is the same way. Bzip 2, and that is bzip and the number 2, that's the name of the application. Bzip 2 archive.tar is going to bzip archive.tar into archive.tar.bz2. And once again, to unzip it, it's bunzip to archive.tar.bz2, or you could, if you're going to do the untar and unbzipping, it's just tar xjf archive.tar.bz2. And that's going to unbzip it and untar it into its respective files, foo.png and bar.og. And then you've got zip, which only time I ever have to use zip, honestly, is when I'm uploading to a server that refuses to recognize the tar.gz or tgz extent suffix. It's stupid, but I guess I don't know why they do that, honestly, but some servers restrict that, and so you have to go with, you know, what everyone else knows, which is zip.zip. So I do, you know, you can zip archive.zip, that's the destination file first, just like with tar, and then you list the files that you want to zip, foo.png and bar.og, and then that's going to zip foo and bar into archive.zip. To unzip it, it's just unzip archive.zip, and that's going to explode it and put everything, you know, all over the directory that someone unzips it into, which will annoy them. So I would have probably in real life made a directory for that zip first. So that's tar, that's gzip, that's bzip2, and zip. And there are so many more compression methods. There's an unrar application for Linux. You know, there's 7-zip, I think, is one. There's all kinds out there. Those are the ones that I use. Now, the sysadmin/os kind of functionality steps in with ifconfig, iwconfig, and dhclient. So ifconfig, of course, hopefully you would know that. Well, maybe you, I don't know, maybe you don't, but usually I think people do who use Linux. Ifconfig is just, if you want to go onto a network, you're going to start looking at ifconfig. So since you're probably on the internet, you've probably looked at ifconfig, and that is, of course, the place that you can find out your IP address, the broadcast domain, the MAC address of the interface, and so on. So that's obviously pretty important stuff, I mean, especially if you're trying to configure your network or trying to SSH, you know, from one computer to the other. You need to know the IP address of that computer, so you invoke ifconfig and look through the interfaces and see which one is the active interface and what the IP address of that is. Now, you can also bring up or down interfaces with ifconfig. So you might say ifconfig, you know, ETH0, your first Ethernet port, up to bring it up, to make it active, or down for that matter. If something's gone wrong, maybe it's something's crashed, you need to bring it down. IWconfig is sort of ifconfig except for wireless. And it also seems to be fairly Linux-specific, because I know that it's not in OpenSolaris, and I do not believe it was in any of the BSDs that I've tried, although I could be wrong. I know it's not in OS X. So iwconfig seems to be kind of a Linuxy thing. I like it a lot. It's very specific for your wireless interfaces, and it will do things for you like iwconfig, for instance, WLAN 0, ESSID, FUBARnet. And that will take your WLAN 0 interface, which is your wireless, my wireless interface, and assign it to the ESSID, which is, of course, the name of a network, to FUBARnet. And that will join it to that net. Now, that doesn't mean it has an IP address yet. It just means that it's going to look at that network when it goes out and seeks via DHCP an IP address. And to get it to ping that network for an IP address, you invoke DH client. And that's always a very satisfying step when you're getting yourself onto a network. You do the DH client. You can even specify which interface you want it to concentrate on, like DH client WLAN 0, and then it will probe the ESSID, the network, that you have told it to look toward with iwconfig, or ifconfig if you're doing this with an Ethernet connection, and it will obtain via DHCP an IP address for your computer, assuming you have permission to be on that network and it's not locked down and stuff like that. So that used to be kind of my three-step process on both Slackware and Debian when I was trying to get onto a network for a very long time, because I never have a network manager installed on Slackware. I really haven't bothered, and I probably won't until KDE comes up with their little plasmoid for their network manager. Slackware gives the option to install WCD or WICD, whatever. I've just never bothered. I don't know why. I just haven't. I've kind of just gotten into the habit of doing ifconfig, iwconfig, dhclient. But that's what I would do. I would sign into Slackware, ifconfig, WLAN 0 up. That brings up my wireless card. Iwconfig, WLAN 0, ESSID, my network, FUBARnet. And then dhclient, WLAN 0. And that was the three-step process every time, and that would get me online, and it was smooth sailing from then on, typically. Screen is an important one. This goes back to more of the OS thing. I feel this is kind of an operating system file manager kind of thing, or actually window manager thing is what it bills itself as, and it's true. Screen is a really cool program, and a lot of people pitched it to me as something that was really, really great because they could sign into IRSSI at home in a screen session, and then they could take their other computer out, be at an internet cafe and SSH home, and then invoke screen and reattach to that screen running IRSSI, and they're just back on just like a champ. And it does that. It actually does that really well. And I think I did a Hacker Public Radio episode on SSH where I also discuss the usage of the screen for that very purpose. But I have since really expanded my use of screen and started to use it more like, I guess, what its authors really intended it to be, more of a window manager for your terminal. And it is really, really nice. I will start using it, and if I find myself needing another screen, which I frequently do, you hit Control-A and then C for Create. And that creates a new screen, quote-unquote, and gives you a new bash prompt, and you can do whatever you want to do. And then if you want to switch back over to your other terminal within screen, you do a Control-A, P for Previous. Or if you want to go back to the other one, then it's Control A in for next. So it's a lot like, for instance, IRSSI when you're changing through different channels in IRC. It's just Control N or Control P. So it's the same deal with screen. Basically, it's Control A to get to your screen, prompt, I guess, or your screen command, and then you do N for next or P for previous. You can do lots of cool things, though. I mean, there's Control A and then capital S to split the screen, so Shift S, and that literally splits your screen into half. I use this frequently with IRSSI on top and Alpine on the bottom. So that whole window, that whole screen is, you know, my two means of communicating, I guess. So you've got, you know, IRC on top, you got your email on the bottom, quite handy. Next command you ought to know is mkfs, make file system, and all of its different variants. You know, there's mkfs.ext3, ext2, dosfs, or something like that. Lots of different ones. Just type in mkfs, and it'll give you a whole host of options that you can do, which is nice. Mount and unmount, or rather, umount, that is something you'll have to know if you're not running X, because you don't have HAL going on, probably, unless you've got a fancy system running HAL even without the graphic environment going on. I think Debian somehow did that. I don't remember how I got it to do that or why it was doing that, and no other system seems to. That was interesting. I'm not even clear on the details on that one, so don't quote me. But even so, you need to, you want to be familiar with mounting and unmounting volumes and ejecting. Eject is a good command to know as well. Just, you know, to actually eject a disk from the optical media, for instance, that's kind of handy. There is also a really, really handy command that's called T, and that is T as in Thomas, E as in Edward, Edward. So TEE directs the output of something that you're doing to a different location. It's not a redirect, though. It's actually a fork, sort of. It's a fork in the road, sort of. But it's parallel. So, for instance, let's say that you're going to do a netstat. If you've never done a netstat, it's a handy little command to show you what connections you have going on to networks on your system right now. If you just run netstat, you get a lot of information. So I do something a little bit different. I do netstat space dash V as in verbose, E as in something, and then capital N as in name resolution, and then space dash capital A, and then space inet space dash C. And then you're going to pipe that to TEE, and then space, for instance, netstat.log. Okay. Now what that's going to do is it's going to first print out all the different connections on your from your computer, to and from your computer. So for instance, I might type in that command, and I'll see, okay, I've got a TCP connection going with a from 192.168.0.5, which would be me, from port 57652, going out to a server called WSIP-98-174-208-105.HR, etc., etc., as the user CLAT2, and so on and so forth. And then it'll list all the different connections I have got going. So if I'm, you know, if I've got a chat application open, I've got an IRC session going, I've got an internet site going, you know, I'm on a couple of different internet sites, I'm going to have quite a few little connections going on there. And as I close them or reopen them, there's going to be a change, you know, in my list. Now I'm seeing this on my screen happening as I do it. But what's happening also is that there is being created in the current directory a file called netstat.log, and netstat.log will be everything that I'm seeing on my screen. So I get to see what's going on as well as keeping a log of all of that via the T command. So check that one out. It's really, really handy, especially for things like that where you are monitoring you know, your network or monitoring a file, whatever, whenever you want to see it, both in your standard output as well as some kind of log, piping it to T is the way to go. That's a very handy one to have. And from there, you know, there's all the normal Unix-y commands. Pipes, redirects, echo, more, less, tail, move, copy, cat, you know, all those different kinds of things that you're going to get on any intro to Unix kind of thing. And I'm not going to go through all those, obviously. I mean, those are kind of, I'm figuring we all know those at this point. If you don't know those, take a step back from the podcast and go learn the basic terminal stuff and then come back to listen to this, because this is more along the lines of the stuff that you're going to use after you've learned the basics of the terminal. But I said that up front, so we should all be on the same page. speaking of same pages, user applications. That's the next thing that I was thinking about. User applications within the terminal are the things, for me, you know, that you do on your computer, that you, you know, you don't go to your computer to do an ifconfig or an iwconfig or a, well, maybe you do for netstat, but, you know, you don't, or to mount and unmount, you know, big deal. What you do at the computer is you type, or you listen to music, or you browse the interwebs, or you email people. So, quickly, briefly, your Office app. Well, you've got Vim, or you've got Emacs. Or, yeah, you've got Nano, or, you know, any of the other text editors in the world. But these are the two big ones that I think people probably ought to get familiar with. And I'm one of the people who kind of thinks that both are equally important. Emacs is really important because Bash uses all the different key bindings of Emacs by default. And I'll get more on that later, but I think Emacs is an important one. And I really do want to start knowing that a little bit better, but until then, I've got Vim. Both of these, Vim and Emacs, have tutorials on your computer already. All you have to, well, possibly not already, but you should. But if not, you can install, I think it's ViTutor or VimTutor, and it will teach you how to use Vim. And Emacs, the same way. You do Emacs, and I think it offers to give you a tutorial pretty early on. So, you know, both of these are maybe not easy to learn, but there's certainly a way to learn them. And the more time you spend in them, the better, the quicker you learn. And that's just how it works in computers and a lot of other stuff in life. It's not comfortable or fun at first, but after a while, you know, you start to catch on. So that would be your Office application, I would say. Your web browser, of course, there's eLinks and all of its different variations. There's Links, LYNX, there's Links, LINKS. I think there's one called just Link, LINK. So, you know, you've got lots of different ones. I've used so many different... I've used Links here and Links there and eLinks there. I don't remember which is the one that I actually like best, but there is one that I do like best. There are really subtle differences, though, and typically I just end up using whatever happens to be installed on the computer and don't really think twice about it. Media player, of course. I think most people know of a couple of different command line media players, so that's not that big of a deal. The one that I, to this day, keep using is MPlayer. I like it because it plays everything I want it to play, and it's got that handy mincoder functionality as well, so if I ever need to transcode or something like that, I can use mincoder for that as well. You even have image manipulation in the command line. Of course, ImageMagick. ImageMagick, I did a brief Hacker Public Radio on episode on. It barely touches the functionality of ImageMagick. ImageMagick, I don't even bother with a man page half of the time. I prefer to just go to their site, which I'll try to include in the show notes. There's a documentation on their site with all the different functionalities and examples and things like that. Do not try too hard to script ImageMagick. Chances are it's already built into the application. I spent 4 hours one night trying to script something for ImageMagick, trying to get it to crop some screenshots. And turned out the exact function that I needed was already built in. It was so quick. It was just right there. If I'd read the documentation online, I'd have known it. So the documentation is a little bit overwhelming. So just it's a lot easier to just go to the site and kind of click around, I find. Of course, it's got lots of little sub programs like convert and display and all. Well, display is not going to work for you without X, but convert, transmogrify. Which is why the documentation is so enormous, I think. You've got audio editors like Sox and Play and Record. Play and Rec, REC, are both part of Sox. But yeah, you've got editors for audio. You've got Normalize, which will normalize your audio. Check that one out. That's a really good one. I'm going to have to do a whole episode on, or a whole segment on Normalize. That's a really fancy little application. I like it a lot. You've got a video editor, as Peter64 himself will tell you, FFmpeg. Yes, you can edit video with FFmpeg. Technically speaking, you can do it with MPlayer as well, but FFmpeg makes it a little bit easier, although not super easy. But FFmpeg will transcode videos and audio if you use the -vn tag, video no. That's really handy. I use FFmpeg every day. Internet chatting, you've got IRSSI for your IRC sessions, and that's a really great one. If you're not using that, you should. It's really simple. IRSSI space --nic space I don't know, Klaatu, whatever your nickname you want to use, and then you'll be logged into IRSSI, or rather, you'll have started IRSSI, and then you just do /server /irc.freenode.net, and that will log you into the Freenode network, and then you do /join /#LinuxCranks, and then you join the Linux Cranks channel, and then you say hi to me, and you ask how to do something else in IRSSI, and I will tell you. If you do the whole, you know, instant messaging thing, you can try out a little application called Finch, and this is an application that 330 let me know about, and I used it like once, and then I stopped using instant messaging, not because of Finch, I just kind of got out of the habit, plus I was looking for something other than AIM or Google Chat to use, so I've since found one, Jabber, of course, jabber.org, opened an account there, so if you look for notklaatu at jabber.org, or add that to your instant messenger. That is me. Email, of course, Alpine. I've done like a grand total of 2 Hacker Public Radio episodes on this. They are very complete. They are very good. I actually listen to them myself whenever I need to reconfigure Alpine. One of the episodes is on Alpine and IMAP, and the other is on Alpine and OpenGPG. So both of those are really good episodes to listen to. Alpine is a fantastic mail client. I know it's not, I don't think it's entirely, like, it's not GPL, I know that. I think it's not GPL. But it is, it's really good, and you should use it if you want to use a really good email client in your terminal. There's also Mutt, but that requires a lot of configuration outside of Mutt. You actually have to have, like, postfix and send mail or something, you know, some equivalent of those things set up and running on your computer. And while that is sort of something that I can do, I'm not quite clear on how to do those things in relation to having email not coming to my actual domain name, which is not, you know, obviously looking out at the world. So there's some configuration stuff that I have to figure out in order to get Mutt going, and I would like to do that simply because Mutt is, I think, more GPL'd than Alpine, but that's going to have to wait till I can learn a lot more about email and MTAs and MUAs and all that other good stuff. Those are the big user ones. I mean, and I think that covers practically everything. I mean, video editors, audio editors, picture manipulation, chat clients, Office. I mean, what more do you want out of a computer, really? Those are some really good applications. And you might think, oh, well, what I really want is a command line synthesizer. Well, Sox gives you that as well, so I already covered that. Yes, it does. There's a couple of other ones that I guess fall under what I think of as kind of a sysadmin kind of task, like LSPCI. That's such an important one because it tells you, and I always forget about it, but it tells you what's inside your computer. You list all the PCI, everything connected to a PCI bus, I guess. So LSPCI shows you all the little hardware bits and pieces in your computer, which helps you when you're looking for specific drivers or you need to know what driver to look for at all. LSPCI is probably the way to at least certainly the thing you're going to want to start with. Of course, there's also PROC. You're going to need to probably probe around PROC on occasion. But LSPCI is the one that I think more often than not, that's the one that's going to answer a lot of the driver questions. There's LSUSB, which is handy when you're troubleshooting, you know, why isn't this external drive being recognized? LSUSB, it'll tell you what USB ports you've got in your system, and if something's connected, it'll tell you what's connected. Of course, there's the /configure, make, and make install. Especially if you're doing something on a system that you're not running X on, you know, you're probably getting geeky enough at that point to just start compiling your own applications. Yes, there are times when you should compile, and there are times you should not compile, speaking from the convenience standpoint. You know, do you want things to just automatically be updated with, you know, by your package manager and things like that? If you're not doing it through the package manager, it's not being logged into its little database or whatever it keeps, so it doesn't know to update that application, which could be a good thing, it could be a bad thing, it just all depends on your specific needs. But the /configure, make install, it's important to start getting to know, I think, because, well, I mean, Dan said it best in a blog posting of his, Linux does have a universal package format. and that is source code. That's Dan from the Linux Link tech show. And he's right. That is absolutely right. Source code is the universal package format for Linux. And if you know how to compile, you're not going to ever have to worry about a package not having a .deb or a .rpm or a .tgz or whatever the other package formats are out there. You're not going to need to worry about that. I should probably do an episode on that alone as well. That's one of those things that complex enough to deserve more attention. I did something on it way back in, I think, season 2, but I've gotten better at it lately, so I should share my experiences. Another one, big important one, of course, is SSH. That's huge. I use it every day, many times every day, probably. It's just it is one of the reasons that I switched to Linux, I think. That was one of the cool applications that was just way too incredible to pass up, and it was certainly one of those things that, well, it's just, once you see the power of it, it's hard to go to a system that doesn't have a fully integrated SSH. And by fully integrated, I mean, of course, OS X. You SSH with X forwarding on OS X, and guess what kind of stuff you get to see? Nothing, really. You don't get to open up your Firefox, you don't get to open up Thunderbird to check your email, because those aren't X apps, those are Cocoa apps, and you can't forward those. So that's a big drawback of SSHing into systems that don't have an X windowing system, which is why I use only Linux, and I don't try to integrate with other systems if I don't have to. And if I am integrating with OS X, I at least make sure that they've got some X applications installed that I can use if I need to. Although, word of warning, if you install the X11 version of Firefox onto an OS X system that also has the Cocoa version of Firefox running, you're going to run into problems. Just a little warning for you. And I'm speaking from experience. So, anyway, SSH is really important. And I've done Hacker Public Radio episodes on SSH, so you can certainly check that out as well. SCP, of course, is the copy function in the SSH, so that's really handy. The cool thing that I've gotten into lately is actually just grabbing something from a remote location and copying it over to my computer. I used to have to kind of SSH into that remote computer, poke around, look for the file, and then SCP it back to myself. But if you know where something's located, you can actually just do an SCP GORT at 192.168.0.3:/home/GORT/docs/foobar.txt, and then say, okay, dump it here, so /foobar-GORT.txt. And so then you've got, instead of having to SSH over to that computer and then copy it back to yourself, you're just copying it over to yourself. It's a little bit faster. rsync, another one of my favorite applications. I'm pretty sure I did either a Hacker Public Radio or a Bad Apple segment on that as well. That's what I use for backups primarily. That's what I use it for. It's a great application. Don't know the impact of there being an R rather than an S at the front of it. You know, it's a remote sync. It's not a secure sync, but whatever. I don't use it over a network. I connect my drive. I do an rsync-av /home/clat2/media/backup/clat2/backup. And that's what I do. OpenGPG, great application. Again, I've done a Bad Apples episode or segment on this back in either season 2 or 3. Just have a look at the archives. You will find it, or I'll try to link to it. It's a great application. OpenGPG. You know, I mean, not only is it great to have it on, you know, as a way of identifying each other over email, but it's great to have in case you need to encrypt stuff. So getting to know OpenGPG is just a neat thing to do, and it's not essential. You can use Linux for the rest of your life without ever using OpenGPG, but it's kind of cool to know it and to get into the habit of using it. And speaking of OpenGPG, I believe there's going to be an OpenGPG, or I guess one would call it a PGP key signing party at Ohio Linux Fest. So if you're going to Ohio Linux Fest, be sure to look into the PGP key signing party so that you can get your little key, you know, verified and stuff like that.
Come celebrate 40 years of Unix at the Ohio Linux Fest from September 25th through the 27th. If you use GNU Linux, BSD, OpenSolaris, or any Unix or Unix-like system, you belong at Ohio Linux Fest. Register free today at ohiolinux.org.
The big question, I guess, at the end of the day, is when you're using Linux and you're not using the X environment, or you're using Linux and you just want to be more familiar with the XLS environment, what do you really need to know? Do you need to know little applications and commands, or do you need to know the shell itself, or do you need to know files? And of course, the answer is all three. If you know commands, then you know what to do when you're in a shell, and that's cool. You know all the cool little applications that you can use, and the cool little shortcuts that you can do to cat a log into the end of another log or something like that, whatever you're going to do in the terminal. But you can work even faster if you know the shell itself. And I've done a Fedora Reloaded segment on kind of like some of the most important bash shortcuts. And I say bash because, of course, bash is just the one that you're going to find on every system, really. I mean, it's been around forever, I guess. And even though, yeah, there's CSH and TCSH and ZSH, and those all have their different strengths, bash, I've found, is just kind of the one that I like to know the best because, I mean, you can find your way around the other shells as long as you know a shell. But, I mean, in terms of knowing how to do things on a system that you're going to hack into, like your Nokia, for instance, and suddenly you find yourself at a, you know, with an emulated keyboard that doesn't have an up arrow key or doesn't have a delete key or an escape key, and you need to do stuff, and you want to do stuff quickly. You don't want to have to retype the entire command. Well, if there's an emulated control key, for instance, then you've got all your bash shortcuts. You've got control P for previous, control N for next. Well, I don't suppose you use that, but control P will go, scroll you through history. For instance, control R would search the history for you. Control A would move you to the beginning of the line. Control E will move you to the end of the line. Control L will clear it, so that you don't have to actually type clear, C-L-E-A-R, just control L. A lot faster. Control F, of course, forward. Control B, backward. Control D to delete, or Control W to delete the whole word. Control K to cut an entire string, and then Control Y to yank that string back. Things like that, and just the fact that you can do a command with the ampersand, the little and sign at the end of it. And that will issue, it will invoke that command and then return you to the bash prompt. This is really significant if you want to, start something, transcoding, for instance. Like you want to do an FFmpeg, in file dash VN out file, and then with the ampersand sign, it will start that transcoding and it will send it to the background so that it's not taking up your bash prompt. And the other thing that you need to know, I guess, are the files. Where the files are on your Linux system. You need to know, for instance, the /etc directory is going to have a lot of your system configuration files. Your init.d directory is there. Your x11 directory is there. Your HAL directory is there. All these configuration files I found recently, at least on, I think it was on my Fedora system, that there was a .vimrc in my /etc directory, which really surprised me. It actually really annoyed me because I was issuing some vimrc commands of my own that seemed to be counteracted by the system.vimrc. And I could be wrong on the, I could be fuzzy on the details there, but it was something was screwing me up, and I couldn't figure out what it was until I realized that, sure enough, there was a system configuration in my /etc folder. You want to know that kind of stuff. Of course, you want to know that hidden files exist in your home directory that dictate a lot of your personal settings. You want to be familiar with /boot/grub or /etc/lilo. Depending on what system you're running and what bootloader you've got installed. So that's important to know about. You want to be familiar with things like /sbin and /bin, /usrbin, /usrsbin, or depending on your system, it might be /usr/local/bin. I think OpenSolaris and OS10 both do a lot of the user applications in the /user/local/bin. You just kind of want to be familiar with that stuff because at some point you're going to want to know where to look for a certain application, and you might not know enough of the application name to know to do like a which, application name, and you're just going to have to do an ls and kind of just poke through the directory and see if there's something that looks right to you. So you kind of want to just be familiar with these kinds of concepts. So between knowing a shell for the shortcuts and the way that you're going to interface with your computer, knowing the files so that you know where to look for configuration and functionality, and then knowing the actual applications, that should set you on a pretty good path toward being really a pretty solid, I think, user of Linux, whether or not you have, for instance, X installed, or a familiar X environment. That, of course, is something that is worthy of note. I mean, someone who just lives in one environment all day, I heavily favor KDE and Enlightenment over something like, for instance, GNOME. So if I'm sitting in front of someone's computer and it's a GNOME computer, knowing the command line stuff might make my job a lot faster. That, my friends, is about all I have to say about command line applications. I hope some of it was helpful. I know there was probably a lot of stuff for a lot of people that was just completely repetitious, and they're probably thinking, yeah, those are such basic applications, Klaatu. I can't believe you dedicated an episode to that kind of stuff. But hopefully some people hadn't heard of some of these things or weren't really clear on how to use them, and hopefully I was able to clear up some of that for some people. So if that was you, you're welcome. And if you were one of the people completely bored, sorry. And that was, I guess that was that, really. That's a pretty good length episode on command line applications. So, hopefully that helped, and, certainly if you need to contact me, if you have other cool applications that you use, for instance, you know, I just saw on I think, IRC this morning, Claudio M was talking about, an application called Watch, W-A-T-C-H, and that, watches a file for changes, which is kind of neat. So if you have anything, you know, your favorite command line application that you use, whether it's kind of that quote-unquote user application or more of like an OS / sysadmin application, send it my way. I'd love to talk about it maybe in listener feedback on, you know, the next episode or the episode thereafter. It just depends on how quickly you email me and how quickly I do the next episode. So yes, you need to contact me. It is at klaatu@hackerpublicradio.org or klaatu@linuxcranks.info. Either of those will do. As I say, I've got instant messaging now, so it's not klaatu@jabber.org, I think is my name, and the Klaatu, the K, is capital. So it's not, and then capital K, Klaatu, at jabber.org. So I've got that. Let's see, I've got IRC, of course. I'm in hash Linux cranks a lot. I'm in hash a lot of Linux links a lot. And, you know, wherever else I happen to be. And the website, of course, is thebadapples.info. So, and I'll try to have as many relevant show note links for this episode as I can think of. So, thanks for listening, and have a good week.
Powerful!